talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I want to start today's show by saying a few words about Rob Lori, WMNF's co-founder and the station's longtime news and public affairs director, who passed away on Sunday. 20 years ago, when my family and I were gearing up to move from Southern California to South Florida, I contacted several radio stations aiming to find a home for my then two-year-old show, Talking Animals. One of those I pitched was Rob Lori, who agreed to give me a half hour on-air tryout. So I booked Nellie McKay, an acclaimed singer, songwriter, and animal advocate whom I had already interviewed on the show and knew she was an eloquent, charismatic guest. I did the tryout show, it went really well, and Rob started me out at WMNF with a half hour monthly time slot. So in addition to all his great programming here at WMNF and his weekly show at WEDU, he helped launch a number of reporters and hosts, myself included. And 20 years after that tryout, I'm still here hosting Talking Animals. Thank you, Rob. Rest in peace. And my heartfelt condolences to Rob's family and all those who loved him. It's a towering loss. Meanwhile, my guest today is award-winning filmmaker Joshua Zeman. Amidst renewed focus on the war in Ukraine, ongoing analysis of the debacle that was Friday's Alaskan summit and Monday's broader powwow, Zeman's new documentary, Checkpoint Zoo, arrives in timely fashion, providing a distinctive window into the Russian-Ukrainian battle. Checkpoint Zoo documents an unusual rescue mission undertaken at Feldman Eco Park, a zoo and multipurpose complex near Kharkiv, Ukraine, housing some 5,000 animals. The film captures pivotal moments, large and small, starting shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine, where a reduced zookeeping staff did its best to feed and care for the animals at Feldman Eco Park, while some of the more aggressive fighting raged nearby. I want to be careful about spoilers, but Checkpoint Zoo takes flight when the decision is made to stop trying to care for the traumatized animals on site in favor of the crew, now additionally consisting of volunteers, evacuating those animals, first to the estate of Echo Park owner Alexander Feldman, eventually to other zoos and facilities. Checkpoint Zoo is a documentary that unspools like a thriller and along the way raises questions about the wages of war and animals in captivity. We'll delve into these questions and more when I speak with Joshua Zeman in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's show, I'll speak with Adam Sigulski, who leads the efforts of Bear Defenders, a coalition dedicated to ending bear hunting across the United States. Their singular focus recently was opposing the bear hunt that the FWC voted to approve last Wednesday in a meeting in Havana, Florida. Adam was at that meeting, so we'll hear a bit about that and next steps for animal advocates who aren't resigned to accept a bear hunt slated to take place starting December 6th and more when I speak with Adam later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss Checkpoint Zoo with the man who directed the film, Joshua Zeman, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Joshua Zeman back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. When we spoke previously, you had just made a documentary called The Loneliest Whale, a film quite That's different, right. I think it's safe to say, from the new one, Checkpoint Zoo. So before we get into talking about Checkpoint Zoo, which I look forward to, I really enjoy the film, and it's a power. I sort of said it as a documentary, it kind of unspools like a thriller, which is really the case. But I'd just be kind of curious to know how you went from The Loneliest Whale into this. How do you typically, or in this case, contemplate the next film? Like, sort of walk me through the process. You finished a project, in that case, Loneliest Whale, concluded the promotional obligations, et cetera. How do you start figuring out kind of what your next film might be?
Well, you know, I think one of the interesting things is I'm always into the mysteries of animals. And whales have this unique mystery to us. Our relationship with whales, what are whales really thinking, the sentience, the whole story of whales to me is one giant mystery to kind of unpack. And so that film also is an expedition. So there's a natural structure to that film as an expedition, you know, a beginning, middle, and end, and trying to find that whale in the little amount of time we have. So this film again, I wanted to explore the mystery relationship we have with animals. This film, kind of like the structure of an expedition, is the structure of a Mission Impossible. How these volunteers and zookeepers can evacuate 5,000 animals from a zoo while being bombed. So that was the lens that I went in with. But really, at the end of the day, I saw an article on the front page of the New York Times. The article spoke about a chimp named Chi-Chi. This is about 4 months into the war. Chi-Chi was staying temporarily at the Kharkiv Zoo. Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine, only 30 miles from the Russian border. It had been evacuated from a place called Eco Park Feldman, which had been bombed terribly. And Chi-Chi had escaped. Chi-Chi was probably trying to get back home to Eco Park Feldman. But Chi-Chi was walking through the middle of Freedom Square, which is in the center of Kharkiv. And almost right there, you know, as a filmmaker, you have to recognize the moments when they're right before you. And it was this story of this chimpanzee looking for its freedom while the Ukrainian people were looking for their freedom from this bombing and this war. But it was also, what was very interesting, it was actually a piece of video. And the video panned across the crowd. And the crowd of Ukrainians, they were all smiling. And it was just so striking because these were people who were being terribly bombed. They didn't know if they were going to live from one day to the next. Yet they see this animal and suddenly they're smiling. And so I realized as well, that's the power of animals, just not just to bring a smile to our face, but to give us hope and a regained innocence in the middle of a war. And so that is the kind of theme that I went into this story with.
So I'd be curious to know, Joshua, because it sounds like that New York Times, the Chi-Chi thing kind of really was the catalyst in this case. But I'm also guessing that as a longtime filmmaker, you probably always have a few different ideas that are floating around, maybe a running list of like, hey, maybe I'll do this, or if I find some other element, this will combine with this to make the kind of film I might be interested in next time. So were you also kind of along the way sort of thinking somewhere in your mind, I'd like to tackle a war-related film if I can find some other story that connects to it that makes it work for me in the way I'm interested in the mysteries of animals?
Of course. I mean, absolutely. So many. War is one of those enigmas of human nature, I think, that we always want to explore. We want to try and understand it. Why does it happen? Why do we continue to do so when we know in our hearts how horrible it is? So, yeah, I would, like many other filmmakers as well, and just a citizen of the United States, I was very shocked at what was going on in Ukraine. It was such a big story. It felt so big because it was being compared to World War II, and I think that we all knew this was a pivotal moment. So that was definitely part of it. I had always wanted to do a war film, but war has been tackled so many times. How do you do it in a way that's interesting, but also really emotional? And that, you know, war by definition is created to strip away our humanity, the brutality of war. But what I found and what's so interesting is that this group of individuals, by saving animals, they find their own humanity again. And almost they become superhuman, if you will. It's not just that they find their humanity, but they find empathy, compassion, selflessness. They become better people than they ever were before.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk about them and kind of this whole idea of these people signing on to help this sort of mission, this kind of esprit de corps that kind of develops amongst these volunteers who are bound and determined in the way you just described to help these animals at first, trying to care for them on site, as I mentioned in the introduction. And then at some point somebody says, okay, we have to, we can't keep doing this. They're traumatized, they're getting bombed all the time. We have to re-evacuate them. And, really interesting people and kind of where they came from, sort of disparate backgrounds and mm-hmm. It really interesting. So, but still, seems like, well, as far as a filmmaker goes, you found your war thing. Chi-Chi kind of led the way, I guess, held the hand out and sort of said, here's your war film. And, but still tricky and dangerous, obviously, to go into a country that's still deeply in war, as we've covered just in the last few days of apparent attempts to end the war, which we'll see how that plays out in, I guess, the coming days. But
yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. So early on, did you envision profiling a zoo full of animals amidst aggressive warfare would yield something more than a compelling story about a zoo or a horrific war story, that this whole would amount to far more than the sum of its parts?
That's actually a really good question. So, and to continue that story a little bit, I saw this article about Chi Chi, this piece of video. Literally the next day, I typed in on Google, Feldman Eco Park. A number came up. I called them, and I don't speak any Ukrainian. They don't speak any English. I said, you know, I'd like to do a documentary or thinking about it. They said, oh, we'll get somebody to call you back. So the PR head of the zoo, who speaks a little English, called me back the next day. And of course, the Ukrainians are so happy that people were covering the war, telling the world about their experience. But he said to me, he says, we would like it very much if you could think about doing a documentary. Would you like me to send you a piece of footage that went viral? And I was like, yes, please. And he sent me this one clip of this one young volunteer, Timothy, who has his cell phone out. He's kind of taking a video selfie. And he's driving this Sprinter van. And Timothy says, you know, I think it was the 4-month anniversary of when the war started. We're here evacuating the animals. And he moves his phone and he shows the back of the Sprinter van. And it's all these kangaroos in the back of the Sprinter van. And it was just unbelievably cute and amazing piece of footage. And I said, Vadim, this is great. And he says, I have more footage. Would you like me to show you? You know, and so basically every night he would send footage. And it was very interesting and kind of answering your question, because I was just seeing all these moments. Like, you know, when you watch YouTube and you see two people disentangling a whale and the whale kind of turns around almost. You think the whale is turning around and thanking them for doing it. Or you see two people removing a pail or a bucket or a glass jar from the head of a bear, or, you know, a raccoon that's got its head stuck and they pull it off and the animal turns around and looks at them, and you think you're seeing them say thank you, and they probably are, of course, but it's that moment. The film is filled with all these really tiny but beautiful moments of this interaction, this interconnection between humans and people in the backdrop of this war, and that is what I really wanted to explore. Of course, this is all happening in the backdrop, and you know, they had to evacuate 4,700, well, they had to evacuate 5,000 animals. So we also said, okay, well, let's try and make this film like one of those World War II 1970s where Eagle Dare, Impossible Mission movies, or Inglorious Bastards and all that fun stuff. So envisioning the film like that to become this Mission Impossible to rescue all these animals, it really ended up kind of telling itself in some respects. We just had so much footage that was being sent over to us that we had to kind of lay out. We didn't speak any Ukrainian. We had to lay it out. There were like 3,000 clips, and then just get the longer interviews, which I went back to Ukraine to go do.
Wow. Well, let me let folks know who may just be tuning in and not know who they're hearing right now. This is Talking Animals. I'm WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is award-winning filmmaker Joshua Zeman, whose new documentary, Checkpoint Zoo, provides a distinctive window into the Russian-Ukrainian battle. Film documents the challenges faced at Feldman Eco Park, a zoo, kind of multi-purpose complex, really more than just a zoo, near Kharkiv, Ukraine, housing some 5,000 animals when Russia invaded Ukraine, followed by intense fighting and shelling. So it's in select theaters now, and to me, it's a documentary that really unspools like a thriller. If you'd like to ask Joshua a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And we actually do have a caller holding, so let's get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, Joshua Zeman.
Good morning, Duncan. I'm Bert in Braden, and am I speaking with you now?
Yes, you're on the air with Joshua Zeman and myself.
Great. Thank you. At first, I want to say that animals should have the same rights as we do. We can now supposedly communicate with whales, dolphins, and chimpanzees. And with the politics today that doesn't seem to care so much about humanity, cares even less about animals. And it's a real shame. And I'm a little off topic here, but I wanted to make you aware that there is a very cool video on YouTube about cats. how they interpret what we do and what we say to them, and how they respond and interpret to them. And I just wanted to make you all aware of that as well. Another venue you might be opening to communicate better with animals.
Okay, and just out of curiosity, were you involved in the making of that cat video, Bert?
No, I've been watching.
Okay, just a fan of it.
Just a fan of animals. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I appreciate your call, but you should continue to listen to this conversation and have a chance to check out Joshua's film, Checkpoint Zoo. I think you're obviously a target audience for this kind of film.
Yes, because I think even our national zoos, even our zoos are in danger.
Yeah, well, we're going to get into the whole philosophical question of zoos, pro and con, and later in the conversation for sure. So be sure to kind of stick with us, Bert. Thank you.
Thank you for your service, Duncan.
Thank you.
And your guest.
Thank you. Okay, Joshua, sorry, you look like you're about to add something there to what Bert had.
Well, it's just interesting because the caller is correct, but in fact, what we saw this weekend, you know, here you have a president going out somehow making decisions for the Ukrainian people. And our film is a film about sovereignty of animals, ultimately. And it's just so interesting. I was just at a Q&A when the Ukrainian consulate was there, and it was the interesting analogy of here you have a country the Ukrainian people are trying to stand up for their sovereignty, while the animals in our film are trying to stand up for their sovereignty, their freedom. And it was just a very weird fact that we opened up our film in New York while this was going on.
Yeah. No, the timing. I mean, this interview with you had been scheduled, you know, some days ago. But as all this stuff happened in Alaska and then Washington, D.C. Monday, I thought, wow, this is very odd coincidental timing. Mm-hmm. And maybe let's try to think that it bodes well, even though it got off to a rocky start for sure there in Alaska. But you know, some of what you talked about contacting the guy, and again, he just sounded like an ongoing treasure trove of clips and videos and stuff. So there appears to be kind of a certain time travel element to the filmmaking that produced Checkpoint Zoo, meaning to present the early parts of the film, you had to kind of round up that footage from this guy, maybe elsewhere, videos and social media posts and so on. Can you address kind of any unusual challenges you face as a filmmaker in seeking and assembling those pieces into what would become still ultimately a Joshua Zeman film?
Well, challenging indeed. I don't speak any Ukrainian, so I've never made a foreign language film before. But it is interesting, because somebody just commented to me about this the other day, that when you have these filmmakers, or because some of the footage was shot by the kids themselves, you don't need to understand what they're saying. You see it all in the animal's eyes. And we were just so lucky that a lot of the footage was shot by these young kids who kind of went there to help. And the older folks, ironically, didn't take a lot of video. So before these kids arrive, there's not a lot of video. But the minute these four young men arrive, suddenly there's all these footage of all these selfies with them, with the animals, and it's really quite endearing. But they also just they're out of their curiosity about animals. You could see the way that they were curious and they loved animals and they respected animals. And that really comes through. The other interesting thing was, so I assembled all this footage. There was so many clips, like 3,000 clips. And I said, Vadim, why are all these clips 30 seconds long? And he goes, because TikTok is 30 seconds, no? So they were shooting for social to kind of tell the world about their story, and I had to assemble it all together. But then I went to Ukraine for the first time. I went about 4 months into the war, and it was hot. It was a real war. It was just me and a director of photography. We went into Warsaw. We went over the border. We traveled to Kharkiv, which is all the way across. And I realized I had never, again, made a foreign language film before. I was sitting there interviewing these people, and they hadn't really processed the war because it was only so early in the war. And I would ask them the questions about what does it mean to save an animal? What was, you know, the emotion of saving an animal? Could you see it in their eyes? Could you feel them saying thank you? And the interpreter would take too long to interpret the question. So basically, I just said, forget it. I'm just going to sit there and look at their eyes. And if they were answering the question, I could tell if they were answering the question by talking about animals. And I could see it in their faces. And so, again, it's all about this intercommunication with people, with animals, in talking about animals. That's the point. Talking about what animals do for us as human beings and how they make us better human beings. And when we are empathetic, selfless, it makes us so much better.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it sounds like, I mean, you've already addressed this earlier in this conversation about the expressions that the animals displayed, obviously interpreted as, and I'm sure they were, expressions of gratitude when they were being helped or rescued or assisted in some way. And then you're also talking about, because of a language barrier that you had, these people who participated basically just going on their facial expressions and their body language as well.
Mm-hmm. And when you lean into that, both on an animal side and a human side, you really start to get into the soul of it all. By the way, there was very interesting, these young men, the zookeepers, the volunteers, they had really interesting stories. They would say that there were these predators that they had to evacuate, and they were very concerned about the danger of evacuating these predators. Would they get killed or not? And there were definitely some terrifying interactions that they had with animals that were scared. And, of course, we can't blame the animals. It's the war's fault. But it is potentially life-threatening. So they were trying to figure out, how are we going to evacuate these animals? We'll get these fences and pieces of metal, and we'll kind of direct them into the back of this Sprinter van. They couldn't take huge vehicles, because if they took a big vehicle, the Russians would see them and literally drop, you know, drone missiles on them. So they can only take small vehicles, a Sprinter van. They said, how are we going to get this animal into the Sprinter van? So they back up the Sprinter van to the cage or to the area. They open up the door to the Sprinter van. They open up the door to the cage, and they didn't have to do anything. They said over and over again, they just opened up the door. The animal walked right out and walked right into the van. And they closed the door, and they would drive away.
Like they knew kind of what was happening. They just said, let's make this simple for you. I'll just walk right in so you don't have to worry that I'm a predator.
Totally. I could kill you in a heartbeat. But today, thank you for saving me.
Yeah. No, and it's also interesting as an aside, but an important one, that they also knew enough to know that a certain size vehicle could move fairly safely with a predator or some kind of animal in the back of the van. But if you got to a slightly larger or significantly larger vehicle, you'd be at risk for being attacked.
Yeah, within 2 minutes, if you took a larger, like, box truck, the Russian drones would see them and start to drop bombs. So they had to do so much in a Sprinter, and loading a lion in a Sprinter is not easy. The other story is that basically what happened is they had a bunch of zookeepers, and, you know, the park had been staffed by hundreds of people, but when the war started, and I'm talking tanks rolling into communities and shooting buildings. So these aren't people who just kind of willy-nilly left. They like ran for their lives. So a park that had 100 people, 200 people, now only had 6 or 7 people. And 6 or 7 people to even feed and water a huge park is a unbelievable accomplishment in themselves. But they had to take all these animals out. There were a bunch of zookeepers who were actually killed during that process by Russian forces. It was tragic. So they needed help. And so they put a call out on social media, and 4 kids show up, and they didn't even know if they could. They were nervous at first. They were like, these are just kids. But these kids ended up being braver than anybody. But the first day that they're there, these kids, they're helping a lion, a big cat zookeeper, feed one of these lions. And a bomb explodes literally in the park, and it kind of makes the lion freak out, because, of course. And the lion ends up biting the neck of the zookeeper, and the zookeeper literally bleeds out to death right in front of them. It was a complete mistake. It was not anything that anybody did. It was not the lion's fault. It was not the zookeeper's fault. But then to killing the zookeeper, these kids witnessed that. And the next day, they go back to help again. And I was asking the question. I said, I couldn't believe that you guys did this. And they said, look, there are, you know, there are smart decisions and there are right decisions. And this was a right decision. And so that's the kind of bravery that we're talking about. That's the kind of selflessness and empathy that we're talking about, that these people have.
For sure. Yeah, I've been trying to be careful, and I'll continue to do so to dodge major spoilers. But since you brought up the situation there with that fatality.
Well, that's only the first act, you know?
Yeah. No, I know. Well, I know, but we want to make sure people go see the film. So I don't want to give away all the key turns of events here.
Turning points.
But I did allude to this earlier, and maybe this is a better time to get into it. But the volunteers, in some way, are the core of the film, just in terms of that spirit that you just described with coming back the next day, where I think other people in a similar situation would say, Jesus, my buddy, my colleague just got, you know, killed by a big predator, and we're going back supposedly today to do more predators. I think I might call in sick. But these people had such an incredible spirit, and some of them were, you know, pretty accomplished. There was one, as I recall, who was a veterinarian who was pursuing his PhD, and these people were just saying, you guys need help, we're helping you.
It was a kid, 22 years old. He's trying to, you know, he's a veterinarian, yes, by degree, but I don't know how much experience he has, although we always joke because he comes from a family of 15 people, 15 children, and he worked on his farm. What better experience can you have when it comes to life and death and birth and things like that? But these kids were amazing. They end up taking out the predators, evacuating them, and one of the things that they didn't have was enough anesthesia. And it's amazing because anesthesia is obviously a very difficult, giving any animal anesthesia is a very difficult process to get the mixture correctly. Doing it for animals in war is so much more difficult because you have animals that are highly stressed, number one, so you would tend to give them more anesthesia. Yet at the same time, they're thinner and they're weaker. So if you give them too much, you could kill them.
Yeah.
So you really have to get those concentrations right when darting these animals. And they did not kill one single animal from anesthesia. And I've spoken to zookeepers. I showed the film to a zookeeper, and they're like, I can't believe these kids not only did this while bombs are going off, but they managed not to kill any animals.
Yeah. No, it was really incredible. And I guess we should note for the people listening that this was chiefly to serve as tranquilizers when they were relocating and evacuating the animals. That's why these were being used. But the mix was critical because you didn't know in the film, as you kind of mentioned just a moment ago, that even if an animal is tranquilized properly, the sound or a surrounding environment can jar them more quickly than you would expect. Totally. The proper dosage, or what you thought was the proper dosage. So there was all kinds of juggling and risks, and just hoping for the best along the way, especially when the big predators were being relocated.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite shocking. And by the way, just for your listeners, if you watch this film, you're not seeing animals die, so don't worry about that. We specifically wanted to make a film about people rescuing animals and being heroes. Like true heroes.
Yeah.
And so I guarantee you, you will cry and you will laugh, actually, because animals are also funny. So there's a lot of those moments, but you'll cry tears of joy and happiness, not because, you know, you just can't see an animal get hurt. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And you see all kinds of animals that you may or may not be familiar with that become sort of little sub-storylines, like tapirs, who I happen to have a soft spot for myself, but tapirs definitely emerged kind of as a at least minor co-star of the film.
Absolutely, me too. In fact, I always get a tattoo from every movie, so the tattoo that I got was a tapir tattoo.
Well, there you go. Okay, so again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is filmmaker Joshua Zeman, whose new documentary, Checkpoint Zoo, chronicles the challenges faced at Feldman Eco Park, a zoo multi-purpose complex near Kharkiv, Ukraine, housing some 5,000 animals when Russia invaded Ukraine, followed by intense fighting and shelling. Visit checkpointzoo.com to see theaters where Checkpoint Zoo is now playing, and they're being more and more as the days unfold. And numerous awards, the movie has won at all kinds of film festivals and more. So we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So one thing that's kind of important that relates to some of the footage and some of the younger people that volunteered to help with all the the efforts here at Feldman Eco Park was social media is kind of pivotal, both to how you ended up with a lot of those clips, obviously, but also, I guess, in sort of a notable part of the story as it unfolds on screen. Can you talk to the various ways social media played a role?
Sure. You know, for a lot of the people in Ukraine during this war, social media, Telegram specifically, was the only way that they can get their story out. So it became pivotal. In fact, most of Ukraine and that part of Europe uses Telegram as their main source for social media for contacting people. So what's important to note is when the war started, first of all, these people didn't really think that Putin was going to invade. He had threatened numerous times over years. Of course, they had evacuation plans in place, as anybody should, and we can get into that note of evacuation plans in the larger global context of animal conservation, which is very important. But they did have evacuation plans. But what happened was they basically just woke up one morning, 6 a.m., tanks were rolling across the border. They're only 30 miles away from the border. So before they even got to work that day, the tanks were already circling the city.
Yeah.
And it's also important to note that there were a number of zoos and animal parks and eco parks that were destroyed during the Ukraine war. Eco Park Feldman is very unique because it sits on the outside of Kharkiv. We're talking about the second largest city in Ukraine, only 30 miles from the border. The Russians, when they came over the border, they basically drove all their tanks and armament down this one highway, and they start to filter around the edges of this zoo, which is right on the outskirts of Kharkiv. Interestingly enough, the Russians were using maps from the 50s and 60s and 70s. They thought the zoo was a summer camp, but in the 30 years, it had been transformed into a zoo. And by the way, interesting to note, this zoo was free. It was free to all the people in the community. And the other point to talk about later is the importance of zoos in war. But all the Russians basically went on the edge of this zoo, and they brought all their weapons on the edge of the zoo. And the Ukrainians came out of the city of Kharkiv to protect Kharkiv, and they were on the other side of the zoo. So basically what you had is this, lack of a better term or a quite just term, a no man's land in the middle, and these two opposing forces basically bombing each other. And any armament, missiles, what have you, that didn't hit the other side fell on top of the zoo while these animals were trapped in their cages. So you can understand how desperate a situation it was.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was very important to understand the story. And when these guys were going in to rescue these animals, like, they had to go through the last checkpoint, which is usually called checkpoint zero. In this case, that's why we named the film Checkpoint Zoo. And they would beg the soldiers, let us in. Sometimes they would sneak through to just evacuate some animals before the drones would come. So at first, their mission is just to water and feed these animals. But then as the war continues to intensify and the bombing continues to intensify, and instead of bombing strategic military places, they start to bomb indiscriminately. And even bomb, knowingly, they bomb a zoo, which is just, you can't believe that the Russian forces would bomb a zoo.
Yeah.
It's horrible. So they realize after a couple months that what is just trying to feed and house the animals must turn into an evacuation. And they start, of course, with the smaller animals, with the more docile animals, eventually going all the way to the predators. When they finally reached the predators, they didn't have proper cages. They didn't have vehicles. They didn't have anesthesia. Meanwhile, bombs are hitting all over the park, and they're very worried that the bombs are going to start hitting the lion cages, and the lions will escape. And because they're starving or freaked out, they're going to go around to the community and kill people. So the leader of the zoo, a guy by the name of Feldman, goes on social media and says, listen, we are going to have to euthanize these animals if we don't get help. And it's like the most last-ditch effort. And he goes on Telegram, and it's amazing the response. Literally, the world comes back, and suddenly he's flooded with financial help, dollars. He's getting trucks and cages, specific, transport cages for animals and predators, which are very specific, and people to help. So that's the role of social media, really.
Yeah.
But it's also about the world coming together to rescue these animals.
For sure. Well, Joshua, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, so there's a couple of questions that they actually sort of forecast in a way that I wanted to get to, and I might roll them together because I was very curious to see how working on this project affected your thinking about war. And I guess a parallel question is how working on this project affected your thinking about zoos and other captive settings. So if you want to tackle them together or one at a time, we are nearing the end of our time, though.
Sure. There's a guy in the film who says, listen, everybody could get behind saving a lion, but are you willing to risk your life for a guinea pig? Are you willing to risk your life for a chicken?
Yeah.
And it was just impactful moment for me because you realize that just all life has the same value. All sentient life, all life has the same value. And you have to put the life of a lion on the same par as the life of a guinea pig. You can't make that choice. You don't have the right to make that moral equivalent. So that was one important thing for me. And of course, the other thing is these kids, through the process of seeing animals, not only at their best, like your dog and cats at homes, but at their worst, at their most terrified, they come to the realization that we shouldn't be putting these animals in cages and they deserve their own sovereignty, much like the Ukrainian people. So I don't want to say specifically, I don't think we're going to end the conversation or find an answer to the conversation of zoos. But the point is, the sovereignty of animals is so much important. And when put in the context of war, it really hits home in a way you've never quite thought of.
Yeah, I think at one point someone in the film likens them to refugees, which I thought was really interesting given the context that
absolutely.
The film was unfolding. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And also, lastly, to note, you know, the leader of the park, you know, sometimes we want to do good for children. And there is a long contextual history of zoos in World War II, like the Siege of Leningrad. You know, people were starving, but they refused to eat the animals in the zoo because the zoo was the last bit of innocence. It was the Garden of Eden in the middle of the city. And that is one of the things, that is why this guy had this zoo and wanted to protect these animals, is because he wanted Kharkiv to have this Garden of Eden, this innocence that the children could go in the middle of war and at least have some semblance of normalcy. So it is a complicated issue, but what I will tell you is this. This guy sold everything he has for these animals. He sold wine collections. He collected all these things. He's like Schindler, you know, Schindler's List.
Yeah.
He sold everything, millions of dollars for chicken feed and for carrots and celery. I will tell you that these animals are now 4 years in. This guy has given up everything, and these animals do need help. So if you have listeners, go to www.checkpointzoo.com. There is a button where you can donate food, money for food. I think that that's really all they just want now.
Yeah.
It's money for food to try and keep this rescue effort going. All the animals have been moved out to safer places, but that doesn't mean that they have enough money to feed them.
Right. There's still expenses no matter where they are.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Josh. Well, I think we have reached the end of our time. We're going to speak with Joshua Zeman, the director of the new documentary Checkpoint Zoo. As he noted, there's a website called checkpointzoo.com where you can find out more about the film, the theaters that it's playing in, some of the awards that it's won, how you can help look after the animals, and much more than that. So, Joshua, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals, and congratulations on a wonderful film.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thanks for all your fighting.
For sure. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. In a moment, I'll speak with veteran animal advocate Adam Sogolsky of Bear Defenders. He was on the front lines of the battle opposing the bear hunt. In early July, we had an extended conversation on this show about the FWC's then-proposed bear hunt. And we'll hear from him about the scene of the FWC meeting last Wednesday where they voted to approve the hunt. We'll also ask Adam about recourse next steps for those Floridians unwilling to accept a bear hunt slated to begin December 6th. For all that in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a zoo-related piece from Jeremy Hotz. This is a piece called Bronx Zoo in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
Because during the winter, though, it gets cold. That's the thing about New York, am I right? Absolutely. Freezing. In February, I had tickets to the zoo. They were freezing like an asshole. I went, oh, look at that tiger. Look how realistic he looks. Just like in the wild, frozen to the fence like that. Horrible trip that was. The only guy there that day. I saw the elephant fart that day. That was the highlight of my trip to the zoo. Biggest ass in the world farting. You don't see that on the Discovery Channel. Doesn't even sound like one of our sounds like this. The other animals are running behind it to try and keep warm. tiger was going, point your ass this way. I'm stuck to the fence. And you melt me off the fence with your huge, hot ass. That's exactly what he said. I was there. I speak a little tiger. That's what he said. It was the funniest thing I ever saw. And then it hit me, and it wasn't funny at all. It was an elephant fart right in my face. And I'm wearing the gas permeable lenses. So the image is burnt in my mind for all time.
That was Jeremy Hotz in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Bronx Zoo, taken from his album Lost Bird. Now it's time to talk with longtime animal advocate Adam Sigolski to seek his perspective on the FWC's vote last Wednesday to approve the bear hunt. He was at the meeting, and where we all try to go from here. So let's hear more by welcoming Adam Sigolski back to Talking Animals on WNO. Good morning, Adam.
Morning, Duncan. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for making the time to join us on Talking Animals. I know you're busy and juggling work and other stuff right now, but just wanted to kind of get at least a brief summary, kind of, you know, maybe you could describe the scene at the meeting last Wednesday. And
well, of course, you know, all of us who fought for this are extremely disappointed. But, you know, last week when Gary Nicholas resigned the day before the meeting, and then come to find out they replaced him with Kellum, who was pro-hunting, and then Sonia Rood was on vacation, and then one of the other commissioners who possibly could have been on our side was at a wedding. So it seemed very odd that that shifted right before the meeting, knowing how, you know, so many eyeballs are on this vote. And then one thing, too, they let four gentlemen speak to public comment unlimited. One was a sheriff and one was another politician from an area. They got to speak as long as they wanted to for bear hunting, while the public was limited to 1 minute. So it's like they just completely like seemed like they stacked the deck against people that were against the bear hunt. So that was very disturbing to see. And I almost figured we lost at that point when I saw that happen. I'm like, this is like a dog and pony show at this point.
Yeah, I wondered at what point, if it seemed even initially or shortly thereafter, if there was a kind of a cloud hanging over of sort of a foregone conclusion. It sounds like it didn't take long for that to be the case.
No, and even in the Ocala meeting in last May, I definitely didn't have a good feeling about this, just because, you know, the way they had voted for all these horrible things, like, you know, the use of dogs in bear hunting. I'm sorry, but that is, you might as well just do legalized pit bull fighting. It's the same thing. If anyone has ever seen what happens to dogs and bears, they chase them up the tree, the bear might fall, and the dog just tear them up if it's shot. And bows and arrows, baiting, and the privatization of bear hunting. And when I saw that go through with only one vote against it, I was like, this is not going to be looking good for us. But it doesn't mean that I wasn't going to do the protesting and the outreach, no matter what I thought.
Yeah, you have to put every effort in, no matter what do you think the odds are.
Exactly. So, you know, we're definitely not, you know, we're just going to kind of regroup and readjust. And I think we're going to plan a statewide protest the week before on Black Friday to raise awareness, and probably at Preston Ferrier's auto dealership in Tampa. He's actually a trophy hunter himself on the FWC commissioner. There's a photo of him, like, killed a grizzly bear with a bow and arrow, and he's smiling over it like he just got opened a Christmas present. And so we'll be protesting his, and then, you know, we're doing a full campaign really tying in how cruel dog and hunting bears are. Like, it really is legalized animal cruelty. And, you know, I have that website, thedogwars.com, which is my investigation into deer dog hunting for 5 years, and we're really getting into how what I learned with that practice is going to apply for the bears, and really show people, you know, what's going to happen to the dogs. I mean, to bears if dogs are allowed, which legally they are, but it's not going to be phased in for a few years. So we still think we have some shot at hope at doing something to get the dogs pulled into by 2 years. So
what else? I mean, hopefully the dogs do get pulled, because that seems like just a, you know, extra egregious part of all this. But what else can we take to halt or at least delay this hunt? Or are we already saying, like, December 6th, it's going to pretty much start then, no matter what efforts people take? Or are there some things, the petition of BearDefenders.org, other steps people can take to slow it down, try to derail it, anything that might give us a little more favorable picture?
Well, I know that there is a tactic, which I've seen them use this in other places out west for grizzly hunting, where since it is an open lottery system, people can buy a hunting license, and they can buy a tag, and it's $5 per tag. In the meeting, some hunters complained about that because they say people with more money will be able to buy more tags, and he's absolutely right. There are so many people that are going to be buying these things. And so if you get a bear tag, you get a bear tag. And, you know, I'm hoping a lot of people will get hunting licenses. I own one myself because I am in the woods. And you're afforded certain advantages, like you can open carry in the woods if you have a hunting license and stuff like that. So that's why I have a hunting license when doing investigative work. But we encourage people to get a hunting license. And I think you can sign up to get the lottery tags in September. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah. But the key thing there, the strategy that we discussed a little bit when we spoke at length in early July, is that people are... that have no intention of actually using the hunting licenses or getting the hunting licenses to keep those out of the hands of people who do absolutely intend to use them.
Yeah, and I don't know if you did, is at the end of the meeting, there was one gentleman, I'm actually going to like make a video of this guy. There was a guy at the end of the meeting, pro bear hunter, and he basically told him, we're going to hunt bears whether you let us or not. And that's the kind of flagrant disregard some of these bear hunters have for wildlife.
Yeah.
They think they own it because of like, you know, the wildlife conservation North American model, which wildlife is a trust for all of us, not just hunters. And like we talked about before, the non-hunting community puts more into conservation than hunters do these days. And it's verifiable. So hunters, I'm kind of sick of this narrative where they own it. They get to do what they want with it.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing, you know, the long game is, no, we're going to get very involved in the FWC over the next few years, and not on bear issues, but other issues.
Yeah, because it seems like, as we talked about back in early July, I mean, there was all kinds of indications that the majority of Floridians did not want the bear hunt, and yet it just kind of kept marching forward, and obviously the vote last Wednesday was the culmination of that. But it does make you wonder if they're just on a systemic level, if there's something that can be done to address the FWC who can just disregard what seems like the will of the majority of the citizenry that it ostensibly, you know, represents, if not serves. And I don't know what can be done to address that, but it just seems like it's willfully ignoring the will of the people.
No, you make a great point. And, you know, we've worked on bear issues in other states, and I might mention this in the last time, but I don't know what qualification these commissioners have. If you look at all their bios, none of them have a background in conservation. And why are they deciding conservation? Or what? How do they do to get appointed? That's the problem. They're appointed. They're untouchable. So public pressure is one of the only reasons we can get to these people and show them our displeasure through a protest, through a boycott, economic boycott of their businesses. Because, like, if you read the list, developer, I mean, come on, that guy shouldn't even be on a commission. We should have someone who's a scientist, a biologist, a conservationist, and then balance it off with the hunters and the other things, but have a mix, not just one, like, lopsided. You know, 81% of Floridians are against this, and they just don't care.
Yeah. Well, Adam, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but okay. So just in essence, what can people listening who are, you know, outraged that the hunt got, you know, voted in, what can we do? Just kind of keep an eye out for the protests and other stuff on beardefenders.org and other social media of Bear Defenders?
Yeah. You know, I've had a lot of people contacting me, been overwhelming. I know for myself, this has been hard, like mentally, physically, and spiritually, because
people
care so much. And the other side, they don't care like we do about these animals. They want to kill them. We want to save them. But I do tell people, take care of yourself. Like, really take time to decompress. You know, right now we're kind of realigning our strategies, and we have a meeting tomorrow with some like Chuck O'Neill and other people. So just hang tight. This is not over, but also take a time to breathe and enjoy yourself, because you'll fight better next time. You know,
All right. Sounds like sound advice, and we'll just kind of keep an eye out for news on the website and social media, and we'll check back with you at some point on the show probably as well.
Well, thanks again, Doug, for having me on. I'm willing to come at any time you want. So.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your tireless efforts, and we'll get this right at some point for sure.
We will. Take care, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief newscap. But then we shift back to music programming. Sam Vaughn holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by, I believe, Doug Rink is sitting in for Nancy C. today, hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6. And it continues on throughout the day with great music on 88.5 WNF. My guest next week will be Patrick Hardy, a master beekeeper and the founder of Bee Platoon, which aims to protect honeybees and help beekeepers during natural disasters. So more specifically, Bee Platoon helps small hobbyist beekeepers evacuate their bees, recover beehives after disasters, and help first responders move the swarms. So I invite you to join us for that show, and we'll look for you there on TalkingAnimals.net for information, archives, and social media links, etc. It's Talking Animals on WMNF.